comparing a full stack component framework to a web component, I feel like is just a yet another unfair comparison to make. Web components, I think, are a more lower level thing, and they can be used by component frameworks. But again, I don't think they were ever designed to be a direct replacement. And I think the same parallel can be held to the jQuery sort of web platform extensions that were made too. Like, you wouldn't necessarily replace jQuery wholesale with Query Selector, although some folks have argued that that's possible. There's just so much more built into it around event delegation and event binding. And
my name is Skolp Nietling, and this is the Mechanical Ink Podcast, a podcast about open source, the open web, sustainability, and those who want to make the web and the world a better place.
Hey, Zach, and welcome to the Mechanical Ink Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I'm so really chuffed to be having this conversation. Reached out a while ago, and then we kind of back and forth, and then we eventually picked a date, and here it is. And I've been having a couple of, like, had to push things out the last couple of weeks because just, you know, things get busy. And I think you also mentioned when you emailed me, it was like, this month has been a little nuts. And I'm like, yeah, no shit.
Yeah, I keep expecting things to calm down a little bit, but it has not.
No, it doesn't seem like it. Alrighty, well, I think a lot of people that's going to listen to this will already know who you are, but there's going to be people who don't. So for those who do not, please give us like a bit of background about yourself. What do you do? What keeps you excited about tech? Yeah, all of that.
Yeah, I mean, my name is Zach Leatherman. I've been a web developer for a very long time. Probably, I don't know, I think I started my blog in 2007. My website is zachleet.com. And yeah, I've sort of been the sort of front of the front end web developer for, I don't know, since the beginning. I think even before maybe it was a profession. When I went to college, it was for computer engineering. And that was before, I think, front-end web development was even a career to go in. I think all of my collegiate, at least programming colleges or classes, were all Java-based. Yeah, I learned Java from the beginning. And at the same time, I was making websites in my free time just for fun. And I kind of knew that that is what I wanted to do long-term, and that was what I was most passionate about in terms of writing code. And yeah, I was sort of big into PHP at the time and making a bunch of PHP software. And my very first, I think, foray into open source was this piece of software called ALP, Autonomous LAN Party. It was just a tournament software for people that, yeah, did like local area network gaming parties when people used to bring their lug their huge desktop machines to a place and hang out with your friends and play video games for hours and hours and hours. And yeah, I mean, I feel like my favorite part of that was building the intranet website software for the party rather than playing the games. But I mean, I still like games casually, but yeah, I just never really got into it super seriously. But yeah, just like building websites, I think, is maybe the core throughput of my career. It's almost coming up on 20 years here, and I think 2026 will be, I guess, the 20 year anniversary of me being paid to make websites. So yeah, I think a lot of folks know me now for maybe creating the 11D static site generator. I was really, really sort of obsessed with web fonts for a while before that, and some folks maybe knew me for just like web font performance blogs and talks. And yeah, I think I was maybe involved in the Nebraska JavaScript community for a long time. So I don't know. There's been like a bunch of different sort of iterations of me participating in open source and community building. So right now I'm employed by Cloud Cannon as a developer advocate. Cloud Cannon is a content management system, and yeah, they're super supportive of the Eleveny project. And yeah, I think with their help, we're now doing an Eleveny conference, which is pretty exciting. We just launched it last week, and we did some like online ticketing stuff that kind of went trending on Mastodon. The Eleveny project is so much bigger on Mastodon now. We sort of tried to shift everything from Mastodon to Twitter, but I feel like I've rambled probably long enough about my background, uncomfortably so.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I remember the font stuff, and it's interesting that you mentioned that. It made me think about there's this website called Modern Font Stack, which essentially is the idea that do you still need a custom web font? Is modern web fonts good enough that you can actually have a fast loading website without having to load an external thing?
Yeah, I try to think of it in terms of like a box of Crayola crayons. Like you can get the box of 24 and that's fine. But I think the more we work in that space and the to reflect like the rich tapestry of colors that exist in life, we can't always use system fonts. I know that's a very tempting thing because the topic is complex and maybe the easiest way to solve it is to just use system fonts. But I feel like, why would you, just as another example, why would you only use three different musical instruments? Like there has to be more options as we build different things and want different things from our typographic stack. So yeah, I'm still a huge fan of web fonts and type in general. And yeah, I think maybe the most challenging piece of that for me has been how folks are charging for professional fonts now. I think that has challenged a lot of my notions of monetization just personally, because a lot of fonts charge per page view, which I think in many respects like prices out people that want to use them casually or like for side projects or things like that. They become a very commercially focused thing. So it's almost like you have to pay a lot for it, or you have to use a free web font, or you have to use a system font. So there's almost like two camps of typographic use on the web right now, the free font crowd and the very commercialized font crowd.
Yeah, I didn't even know about the whole per page view thing. That is bananas. But yeah, I love typography. So, you know, I always like look for good pairings and use type scale and all those kinds of things. And I mean, when you said about the crayons like 24, immediately what popped into my head was WebSafe colors. Remember that when we had 256 colors to pick from? And like in Photoshop, it would be like, these are nice, and then it blurs out and you're like, okay, I can't use those. That's also something you don't think about.
Yeah, I feel like that conversation is almost resurging with a lot of these new color profiles that are coming out. You're starting to have these conversations, and I'm seeing some of like the folks that work on color specifications and CSS and things like that, and how you can get colors that are no longer reflected by the displays that you want to show them on. And I haven't dived too much into that, but it does kind of remind me of that same thing, that there are still sort of web safe colors. It's just the topic is just much more complex than it used to be. It's not like a pre-selected option of provided values. It's now you have these complex mathematical formulas in which you can generate your own colors and mix colors together, and you can get into situations where colors are not valid for a screen, which I don't even know what happens in that case, if it just like rounds to the nearest color or what. But yeah, I think it's something that is worth learning more about, but there's always just more topics to specialize in for sure.
Oh, yeah, no, that's very, very, very true. And talking about that kind of thing, web components. It's like, finally, web components has arrived. Everybody's talking about it. Dave Rubin can't stop speaking about it.
Yeah, Dave's awesome.
And, Yeah, no, awesome. I always on Shop Talk Show, I'm like, there's hardly an episode that goes by that he doesn't talk about something with Open Components. But
that's great.
Yeah, it's awesome. And I'm so glad it's grown up, because I wanted, like, we had this conversation, like, I used to be at Mozilla working on MDN WebDocs. And when we did the big rewrite of the front end, there was a whole discussion about why we chose React and we didn't do Web Components. And so back then, there was two reasons for it. The one was literally adoption, and the sense that should we want to get another developer on board, it's going to be super easy to find somebody that's well-versed in React. If we go the Web Components route, it's awesome because we're supporting the open web, we're supporting the web platform, which is what MDN's all about. But you're going to have a harder time finding somebody that's also well versed in it. And the support at that time was still kind of all over the place. So you had all this complexity. And because we're a super small team, you kind of have to play to the strengths of the team and that kind of thing. But I feel like I'm talking about like 3 years ago, probably now. So we're in a different world now, right? Web Components has grown up. It's the support is really good, and I just see more and more and more people talk about it. And when I scrolled through your LinkedIn, I just saw like all the web components that you're making, and I thought, like, we need to talk web components. So a couple of questions. So the first thing I want to touch on is you talked on a panel, and I, for some reason, it stuck in my head that it was a Netlify thing, but I'm not sure if it was.
Jamstack conference.
It might have, yeah, it's probably that. That's probably why I think Netlify. And there was a couple of folks that talked about like the future of frameworks. And the gist that came out of that was kind of like the frameworks are kind of starting to imitate one another, not in a bad way, like in a good way, because it's kind of the web is like filling in a lot of the stuff that the frameworks did, right? It's like what jQuery did. Like jQuery came and said, like, this is a mess. Let's just pave over it and make it seem a lot easier than it actually is. And then eventually the web was like, hey, we should just pave these cow paths. And now you just have query selector and all these good stuff. Now with frameworks, the same kind of thing is happening, right? So I'm wondering, thinking back to then when you were talking about all of that, now that web components is a thing and all that kind of stuff, what do you think is the impact of that going to be? Because I know some frameworks is like, you could just use web components, and then other frameworks are like, we're still working on that. So just what are your thoughts around this whole thing and the impact of web components?
I mean, I think different frameworks have like a different, maybe, I don't know, flavor to their opinion on web components. I think some framework authors have really expected web components to be sort of a direct replacement to how they use components now, which I don't think is the right way to think about it. Just as an example, you wouldn't necessarily make every single element on your page a web component, and I would not advise doing that, just because that's not the authoring experience that they were designed for. But when someone comes at it, a component framework developer comes at it with that mindset, it's every single piece of my page that I'm wiring together is a component, a React component, for example, they bring that same mental model forth and expect web components to do the same thing. And I think the other sort of disconnect that exists is the sort of server side piece of the discussion. So when you have like full stack components that you can generate on the server and then hydrate on the client or render on the client, you might also expect web components to do the same thing. And it's, I can see the temptation to also compare those two things on similar playing fields. But really, even though web components are built into the platform and part of the platform, they are a client-side only technology. And there are some sort of niceties around that to maybe allow a little bit better server-side rendering, like architectural models. Like declarative shadow DOM is maybe a good example of that, where it will on the client, inject that markup into your shadow DOM for you without using any JavaScript dependencies. But really, comparing a full stack component framework to a web component, I feel like is just yet another unfair comparison to make. Web components, I think, are a more lower level thing, and they can be used by component frameworks. But again, I don't think they were ever designed to be a direct replacement. And I think the same parallel can be held to the jQuery sort of web platform extensions that were made too. Like, you wouldn't necessarily replace jQuery wholesale with Query Selector, although some folks have argued that that's possible. There's just so much more built into it around event delegation and event binding. And there's just a whole bunch of more layers of jQuery on top of that. And so, you can maybe go pretty far with Query Selector only frameworks and things like that. And maybe that level of complexity for your project is enough. But you see how the same kind of arguments exist for web components and component frameworks too. It's almost as if we need a full stack web component framework to be able to compare to existing full stack component frameworks like Svelte or React and SSR and things like that.
Yeah, very true. So one of the, I don't even know what you would call it, libraries or compilations or whatever, things that I've stumbled upon pretty recently is Shoelace. And the way I stumbled upon Shoelace was I was building a couple of sites and I was like, there's so many things here that I'm just rebuilding every time. What if I took this opportunity to really learn web components, make these web components and create a little library called Common Components and just make that open source and available? And I was like, and then I heard about Shoelace and I was like, oh, that already exists. And I looked at it and it's like, I haven't really played with it much, but I find it intriguing. The one thing that I always, and so I'm always on the fence about these things because, what is the way forward? I'm starting to feel like for me, I've tended to kind of want to build the thing myself. But then I'm like, but that's stupid because there's this whole thing called Shoelace. Why don't I just contribute to that instead if it fits my thinking? I guess that's the biggest stumbling block, right? Unless you have a dramatically different way of looking at things, then it's like, the reason you bought 11T surely was because you were looking at the other things and saying I think this should be different. So I think unless there's something like that, there's probably no reason to not just contribute to something that exists already. I don't even know where I'm going with this, but essentially what I'm trying to get at is how are we going to build websites with web components going forward? Because right now, people would do Vite, Neo, whatever, and you choose your template, which is React, whatever, and you get a bunch of stuff that comes with that, right? So is there a world where there's a Shoelace that's that for web components, or do you think it's not clear cut like that?
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into that discussion. I feel like maybe one of the first things that I would note is that the web is huge. And if you want to build a Shoelace competitor, you should do it. I don't think, even if you have very similar architectural style to what they're doing, I feel like just as an experiment, just go ahead and try and build your own Shoelace. See what happens. See what you learn. Because really, that can be a great learning tool. It kind of goes back to, if you want to really learn a topic, you should write a blog post about it. And that really, I feel like, has fleshed out a lot of my thinking and my mental model around different topics over the years. You think you know a thing, and then you start to write a blog post about it, and then you realize how little you know about it. I feel like that comes out very quickly, especially when you're trying to explain down to the level of detail that I think would be required to make an interesting blog post. So yeah, I guess I would encourage, if people want to build their own Shoelace or their own bootstrap, you should do it, because I think you'll get a bunch of mileage out of that. And there is a certain power in reducing the dependencies that are out of your control. And I know that maybe doesn't have a ton of power coming from me, since I like have written a lot of things that people have used. But I think that the best person in the position to make changes to the things that you use is you. And I mean, selfishly, I think that that is why over the years that I've made and open source so much code, because I want full control over the things that I'm building, so that I can fix things when I need to, and pivot things if I need to as well. And I think that the sort of the attempt to ruthlessly like eliminate external dependencies from my stack is also maybe seen in my web components that I've published too, because every single web component that I've open sourced is zero dependency. Like it doesn't, you just take one file or one JavaScript file and maybe one CSS file, and those are the only two things that you'll need to run those components. And even if like the developer experience isn't great, in terms of maybe it would have been nicer if I would have had like a template literal, like templating library built in, and that would have made the code a little bit nicer to look at or read. But those components are going to work out of the box in 10 years. And I have no doubt about that, because there's nothing outside of the scope of what they are intended for. There's no external libraries that can change APIs. There's no external libraries that could get deprecated or have security issues. It's all sort of under my control. And I think that there is an incredible power in that, especially if you do it long enough, because you build up this sort of library of things that you know and trust. And I'm not necessarily saying that everything I use is stuff that I've built. I don't think that's true. But you do sort of like build this like internal library of things that are things that you built and things that are built by people that you trust to use and maintain moving forward. And yeah, I think that you can get some incredible momentum out of sort of that mindset. So yeah, I don't know if that answered your question. I feel like I've forgotten what your original question was.
No, it does. No, totally. It's good to hear from someone else that, you know, building your own thing, even though something similar already exists, is not totally cuckoo and out there. It's like, it is a learning vehicle. I mean, had I had more time, my idea was to rewrite my blog, but essentially write my own like static site generator, right? So yeah, that I understand how it works. Like, how does all the parts work? How do you go from this markdown file to this website here on the other end? Like, what's all the moving parts in between? Eventually, I was spending so much time doing that, I wasn't posting anything to my blog because it's never ready.
A classic problem, yeah.
So I was like, I should just pick something and have a blog, and then I can do that on the side. But so, yeah, so it's great to know that I'm not the only one doing things like that. So today, I mean, and this is going to evolve, right? Like anything on the web. But today, what would be a classic use case for web components?
Yeah, I mean, any sort of JavaScript client-side functionality on your site, I feel like is the bread and butter of web components. And that's how I've been using them for a while. Maybe one of the first sort of open source web components that I published. And I feel like the one that a couple of people have said that it just sort of changed folks' minds about how web components should be used was the this one called Details Utilities. And basically what it does is a web component that looks for any details elements nested inside and sort of enhances them with additional functionality like escape to close or click outside to close or forcing the state of the details element to be open or closed at certain media query breakpoints. And I feel like there's just a whole bunch of client-side interactivity that you can add to existing HTML elements that Web Components is kind of the bread and butter use case. And that has been sort of cross-browser compatible for many, many years. And I think that is also sort of represented by the HTML Web Components movement that you're starting to see happen now. I think that there's a sort of like, I don't know, folks are organizing around this HTML Web Components term where you're enhancing existing HTML sort of independent of additional specifications like Shadow DOM and things like that. So it's just a simplification of the Web Components landscape, I think, to make it more approachable for folks. And I think that's great. I think I'm also just okay with Shadow DOM for certain things too. So I think that I think every single technology needs that sort of on-ramp of here's where you start with it. Here's the sort of intermediate level and the advanced level can come later. And I feel like if there were just a resource that listed those things out and didn't provide any additional like detail about what those were, I think that that would still be a super valuable thing. Like even like static site generators, if you go to the 11D homepage right now, we have like this getting started guide on the homepage. And for many years, I had just assumed that everyone understood what a terminal window was. Because some of the like initial instructions, it's all command line based, assumed that folks knew how to use a command line, knew what a terminal window was. And yeah, there's all this baseline knowledge that, that was not as approachable as it could be. And the goal of the project is to have let folks get a website up and running just as quickly and easily as possible. And if you don't have that knowledge, then you're kind of left out. And I would love the project to be accessible to everyone because, the web should be for everyone.
Amen to that. So that leads nicely into something I had on here, which is like Jamstack. So Jamstack's a thing that happened quite some time ago, and I believe it initially was JavaScript APIs and markup, right? That's what the Jam was about. And a lot of people would say that today it's just a phrase, but it doesn't really hold true because it's gotten so complex, right? And I think maybe that is what led to yourself and a couple of other people and Netlify, the company themselves, saying like, we need to rethink this whole thing. And I think for me, like a lot of what you just said rings very, very true. This whole idea of the complexity of making a website, like not everything is an application, right? Like web applications, sure, those things are complex and you need complex infrastructure and all that stuff. But not every little thing we put on the internet is a web application, right? So I often see what we used to call brochure sites back in the day. And then you look and you see the very first div has got underscore underscore next. And you're like, whoa, this website is built with a full stack platform, framework. And I'm like, that's a lot. If you tell a junior, like you have to put up this website and you got to use this whole big full stack thing to do that, it's like, oh no, I can't do this. And I think that's a horrible feeling. Everybody's been there, but that's a long way of saying like, what is next? Like where it feels like we're all stopping and saying like, did we make building websites too complicated? And if we did, like, what do we do about it?
Yeah, I think that web development generally didn't go through that same sort of gradual on-ramp, or at least folks have tried to introduce additional complexity without maintaining the gentleness of a nice on-ramp, especially when, because a lot of folks that know Next.js now don't really remember the history behind Next.js and the origins of Next.js as a single page application framework and really being this JavaScript heavy thing. And it is still a JavaScript heavy thing, but they've sort of backported a lot of the server side rendering stuff to it. So that you're at least getting markup delivered on the initial render and not having to render everything on the client. So, I mean, if you understand where Next.js came from, you can see how they kind of shoehorned some of the gentler on-ramp pieces into it, more of as an afterthought, not necessarily as like a core design principle. And I think that there's a certain power in starting with the simplest thing and working up to something more complex rather than sort of jumping over the hurdles to hide the magic in a way of those intermediate steps and saying, you can use this advanced thing to build this simple thing. I think it's better to say you can use this simple thing to build this advanced thing, and showing you how to get there rather than, again, hiding the magic of the advanced thing from users. Because when you have those extra layers of abstraction, I feel like it takes away a lot of the maintenance power and the longevity of the code as well. And that probably goes back to like the third-party dependencies and trying to reduce as many of those as possible and keeping the stack as simple as possible so that it works in 5 or 10 years.
So what is the next? So if we're thinking forward with the web and we kind of just ignore where we are right now, what could the next stack, if you want to call it, look like?
I mean, I would prefer, and I think I said this in that Jamstack conference panel that we talked about earlier, I would prefer a plurality of tech stacks to exist. I feel like Next.js has sort of this almost a monopoly on the discussion in web development right now, just because they have been so successful and they have a ton of developer mindshare. And I think that is a very unhealthy place to be. I think that we need probably 3 or 4 very successful frameworks. And why not more than that at this point? But I would say the same sort of, I think ideas exist in the web browser space as well. Like you see a certain, like Chrome, for example, is a very successful web browser right now, almost to the detriment of all other browsers. And I think the same phenomenon exists in web frameworks as well. People want to choose a winner. And of course, there's a whole bunch of more nuance that goes into that around funding and things like that. But and it's, of course, also much harder to build a web browser than it is to build a web framework. But I think you can kind of see the similarities between the two, right? Tech wants one winner to exist, and developers are very tempted to pick one winner that exists because it simplifies the mental model for them too. Like, and you see the same sort of drawbacks exist in the Next.js community too, because folks say, I have this tool, it works for everything I want to build. But that idea has been very detrimental to the web at large, because you see a lot of drawbacks in terms of web performance and sort of the same sort of starting with that heavy JavaScript bundle that comes with Next.js by default is not necessary for all these different styles of sites that are being built today. I think the sort of silver bullet, one size fits all mentality of web dev right now is very bad. And I would love to see a very successful web components framework, a very successful proprietary like Solid.js or Svelte.js. I would love to see those sort of take away some of the mindshare of the sort of React takes all model that exists right now.
Yeah, agreed. It's also great when that happens because just everything gets better, right? Because everybody learns from one another. I was speaking to somebody the other day, and like that's the core of open source, really, is this idea of many people putting things out there that they think is useful, and people remixing it, you know, bouncing off of it and saying like, wow, that's a good idea, but that's a great idea, but, and in the end of the day, you get these amazing, cool ideas and projects and products that exist because of this culture of sharing and just trying out things. And I do think that if we go and we narrow that pipe down to like just one technology, you know, innovation kind of stops, because why do you need to innovate if you're already one kind of thing?
Yeah, and it becomes beholden to the stakeholders of that project too. I think you can start to see some of the sort of languishing investment in React Core Library too. I've seen some blog posts about how there aren't as high a frequency of React releases as there used to be. And some of the like very major stakeholders in it have moved on to other companies too. So it's very... yeah, it's sort of a very interesting phenomenon to be in, because when you put all, because you have a lot of businesses right now that are relying on that and have put a ton of trust and investment in that. And if it's suddenly becomes less maintained, then I guess a different company can step in, but then you're just beholden to different stakeholders. So if it's not like a community run thing, if it's a very corporate focused thing, that's, in my mind, a very risky proposition. And that's why I sort of have this same, go back to that same mentality of trying to eliminate as many external dependencies from the things that I build as possible, because it really allows more control. But I don't know if I'd advocate for everyone going out and building their own React at this point.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, also, like, this industry moves so fast, right, that if you have to build, like, there's just never time to say, well, I don't want to use React because there's too many dependencies. I'll just write my own. Like, the boss would be like, say what?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, that just the statement, this industry moves so fast, I feel like is a thing I've been thinking about a lot recently, because there are certain aspects of it that move fast and certain aspects of it that I wish would move faster. Although generally I like things to be slow and stable a little bit, like predictable and boring. But in some respects, I wish that the tech life cycle of React would start to fade faster than it has. And the web platform moves super slow, so sometimes I want that to speed up, but I also think that that's a superpower too, that we sort of try and slow it down to get it right. And then once we have got something on the web platform, we usually don't break the web by removing it later, although that has maybe a different point of contention recently with Apple and the EU. But yeah, there's maybe some legal issues there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you want to talk about that a little more. I had that on the list of things to talk about because everybody's talking about it. And it's this whole thing of Apple, well, I guess we'll just say Apple, not liking the... So, interesting story. So I use this app called Insight Timer, and it's a meditation app. It's free for the most part. You can get a plus membership and all that kind of stuff, but honestly, like, you don't really need to. There's so much good stuff just for free, and the community on there is super amazing. It's actually the best part of the whole thing. But they also do some really good stuff. I've heard some not so great stuff about them, but I'll leave that on the side. But one of the cool things they do is, if you're a teacher on the platform, and then people who listen to some of your meditation or take some of your courses, they can make a donation to you. Mm-hmm. And Insight Timer takes nothing of that. They like give everything over to the teacher. Now what's happened with them, and the CEO posted about this on LinkedIn, but it's been coming for a while because I've been seeing in the newsletters and talking about it, but he's now gone to LinkedIn with it. Because what Apple has said now is, hey, those donations are purchases, and therefore we want 30%. And they've said, no, that doesn't sound right. We're not going to do that. And so what Apple's done now is they've blocked them from pushing updates to the App Store.
Wow.
So that is, you know, that it makes me feel less good about my iPhone and my Mac when they start doing stuff like that. And then the thing that you mentioned is they seem to want to use an EU ruling or law or whatever it is exactly to, as a way to say, oh, well, you know, in that case, we're going to have to kill PWAs because, you know, which is actually a self-serving thing because it has nothing to do with all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I can see the temptation that exists. And I think that's why a lot of folks are tempted to give them sort of Apple the benefit of the doubt in this case, because their claim is that the PWA or the add to home screen functionality is sees very little adoption in production sites. And I think there's a good argument to be made that Apple doesn't want that feature to have a lot of adoption. And I think that it is sort of buried in menus. It's been buried in menus for a very long time. It isn't like a first-party feature that they've advertised to end users. And I think a lot of folks don't understand, like a lot of people outside of the tech bubble don't really understand what it does or what it's good for. And I think that it's hard because in web browsers, generally, I feel like folks don't use bookmarks as much as they used to. And that I feel like was maybe the most applicable parallel between the two things when it came to desktop and mobile design UX, was that most people, like back in the day, bookmarks were a huge thing and everyone used bookmarks, and browser bookmarks were a big thing. And I think just adding a browser bookmark to your home screen on your phone is a very obvious thing. But they're sort of using this EU ruling to say, oh, we can't support this feature in iOS anymore because of the security implications of a third-party browser being able to have their own first-party like shortcut on the home screen to whatever site that they wanted. And I think that there is a lot of very interesting, complicated pieces to this. And the biggest one for me is how insecure third-party browsers are in iOS right now. It's like they're complaining about a future problem, but they have not fixed the current problems that exist around user fingerprinting and user sort of monitoring of in-app browsers on existing desktop applications. So like if you are in TikTok right now and you go to, or you click someone's link or whatever in their profile and go to their store, TikTok is monitoring all of the characters that you enter. And I think that's a very common in-app browser security issue that exists on a lot of different apps. I think Instagram does it too. They basically inject this client-side JavaScript into the site as part of the mobile app, which seems nuts to me. And so whenever I like talk to people that are not really in the tech space, I always say never use an in-app browser. You should always like use the, just dump out to full Safari, full mobile Safari on iOS, because otherwise your credit card information, if you're buying something, is being recorded by these in-app browsers. And so there's this existing security problem that is not being fixed. And then they're also complaining about this future problem that may exist if they add to home screen and have it be compatible with third-party browser runtimes. But the other sort of big elephant in the room here is that macOS already does this. Like this is already a thing they support on the desktop version of macOS. And so, yeah, they can talk about maybe the future security concerns, but it's already a design paradigm that they support in their existing APIs on their desktop applications. So, yeah, it doesn't hold a lot of weight for me, and it really kind of feels like they're removing features from the web that they've already shipped and yeah, I feel like that is breaking the web. You're removing things that you've already added. And yeah, it's just the other part that's super confusing and frustrating is that it's only going to happen in the EU. Like, we're going to have browser-specific feature support that's now geofenced to EU only. Like, what? That seems nuts to me.
Yeah, no, for sure. That adds insult to injury, right? And I mean, yeah, I mean, the whole thing about removing stuff from the web that's already there, like, there's a lot of code running in browsers today that is simply there to not break the web, right? I mean, and there's a reason for it, because the web, like you said, like, it's huge, and we don't want to, like, change something that's, it's almost like this idea of where people are like, we should eradicate the world of mosquitoes, and people are like, should we though? Because do we really understand what that means? Like, if we just get rid of this insect species, is there like a butterfly effect here? So, you know, yeah. It reminds me of that. It's like, it seems like this little thing, like, well, we're just going to remove this thing. It's like, how many things are going to break if you do that? Do you really, really know? So, yeah, I don't know. It's a hard one.
Yeah, and I think that the web generally is an interesting development platform for me. And the original allure of it is that it doesn't break in that way. Historically, like, I can make a website. I have websites that I built back in like the 2000 aughts that still work today. And I would expect them to work 10 years from now, as long as I pay the hosting and DNS fees. So, yeah, I really do feel like it's a sort of an affront to the general principles of the web. And yeah, it's very upsetting. I'm not happy about it at all. And I feel like Apple's response has been just almost nothing. I haven't seen any official response, at least in terms of the developer relations community there.
Yeah. But why do you think, like, PWAs have had such a hard time? Like, I mean, people have been talking about PWAs forever, right? Like, I've done talks about it, and it's just never really landed. It's never really landed. I mean, Firefox removed it from desktop, right? You can't install it from desktop. You can on mobile, on Android, but you can't do it on desktop. And then, for example, an interesting one that I've been complaining about for a while is the Arc browser from the browser company. Like, I love the browser. I use it every day, but I can't install PWAs. I don't know why, because it's Chromium based. And the button will pop up for, like, Squoosh, for example. It'll say install. If you click it, just absolutely nothing happens. And then you open it in Chrome and it just installs. No problem. But why is it that that we're having such a hard time to get PWAs to be a thing that people adopt?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is a question of incentives, right? I feel like if the Arc browser doesn't get a ton of, like, developers complaining that this feature doesn't exist, they're probably not going to spend time on it. And I think that is just another question of developer advocacy. If it works in Chrome, it kind of comes back to the monoculture of Chrome. Folks that are building PWAs as a progressive enhancement, you're going to get a bunch of support because, what, we're at like 80% Chrome right now? So, yeah, I don't know. It's a hard problem because I don't think you're going to get some of these smaller vendors implementing these features. And that's why it's, to me, extra frustrating that when you have a platform that did add those at least features in the minimum feature set, at least for that functionality, that it gets removed. I feel like that is just very frustrating.
Yeah, no, I was very surprised when I learned about the fact that Firefox removed it, because I was like, why? It worked. I don't know, was there a security thing? Because usually if Firefox removes something, it's because they are concerned over privacy or security or something like that. And it was literally just an adoption thing. It was like adoption slash maintenance, right? It's like not a lot of people are doing it. It's code that we have to maintain. We're a small team. And I understand that. But at the same time, like, I understand it also from the perspective of, like, what you've mentioned, like, the more dependencies remove, also that makes for a smaller attack surface, right? So you don't have to worry. Like, if you know every little piece of code that's in your code base, you know where your problems potentially lie, and you can put up fences there. So if your code base just keeps growing and growing and growing, and you're like, we don't actually even need that. Nobody uses that. Now we just need to keep an eye on it, because if we don't, we might be exposing our users to security threats. So let's just remove it. But then it's like, oh, but now people that used to think they can install a PWA with Firefox is like, what? Why doesn't it work? And then the weird thing for me is, but then it still works on mobile. So it's like, what?
Yeah, I mean, I think the incentive structure that you should try to exploit is that folks want to build PWAs to work around the app stores. That's like the main impetus. And that is a money-making workaround, because you can then avoid the 30% cut and you have full control over the final code that gets delivered, and Apple can't shut you off from making updates at that point. And so if you are trying to encourage folks to do that, that's the best way to do it. And that is the number one example of why we're in the situation that we're in right now, because Apple knows that folks are going to use that workaround to their 30% cut that they're getting. And they want to me, in my mind, cut off that workaround to make them more money. It becomes just a pure money-making, opportunistic removal of a web platform feature.
Yeah, I agreed. So one of the things that's kind of related, like if you stretch your mind a little bit, is just the state of accessibility on the web. So I think before I have any opinions or anything, I just like to know, like, what does web accessibility mean to you?
I think just it kind of goes back to the same questions that we've been talking about before, that the web is for everyone, and not everyone can interface with the web in the same way. And for me, that's the magic of the web generally, is it puts so much power in the hands of the end user to customize their experience to how they want to browse the web. And you can kind of see that just in a small example with how many folks are adding sort of dark modes and light modes and switchers to their sites. Now, whether that should be a web platform, web browser feature or not, I think is another question. But folks really want as many people to visit their site as possible, whether it's this will make me the most money through selling things through my online store, or this will get me the most eyeballs, or whatever metric you're trying to hit. It becomes an incentive to you to make your web experience as accessible as possible to the broadest audience that you can. I think that accessibility is a huge part of that. It can make you more money. Why would you not do it? I think that, there's some very interesting sort of tensions that exist right now in the accessibility space around vendors that claim to fix accessibility automatically with these accessibility overlays. And I think that's a contentious point to try and make. And I think that the other thing is that people feel like accessibility is this very, very difficult thing. And I think a lot of that comes back to it's kind of hard to test. Folks don't necessarily have screen readers, and developers don't necessarily have screen readers that they're familiar with or know how to test with, and then it becomes a very hard development problem to solve, because if it isn't easy to test, developers aren't going to do it. And then that feeds into, I didn't spend time on it, and now I'm getting bug reports on these accessibility failures on my site. how do I fix those reliably and know that they're fixed in the right way? So yeah, I think that there's a huge sort of gap between the tooling that exists in the space, and it could be almost even more accessible to developers in that way. And that could really go a long way in helping, because if you make it easy for developers, it's that's the first hurdle you need to get over to get some of these things fixed. Because you can push a fix, and if you can't verify that it actually did what it's supposed to do, then it's kind of pointless.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, those are the worst things when it's like, well, when I click here, this thing happens, and when I click, it doesn't. It's like, how do I fix something that I can't replicate? You know, how do I even know that I fixed it, because I can't see the problem. So, I get that. I think one of the other things with regards to screen readers and tools like that is it's they in themselves are inaccessible to the people who need them, but then also to developers, right? Because if you're on Windows, it's okay, because you could do NVDA with Firefox and you're good. It's not going to cost you a cent. It's like open source. It's great. But if you're not, well, now you can use VoiceOver on Mac. But generally, it's a much, much smaller audience. And like web browsers, there's inconsistencies between screen readers.
Yeah, that's another big problem. And again, it kind of comes back to when you get a bug report, how easy it is it to reproduce that bug report with the tools that I have? If someone's using a screen reader that I have no access to, or perhaps one that costs thousands of dollars, then that's very hard for me to even like expense that developer tooling cost for a ticket like that. So yeah, I'm not saying that if you make these screen readers like very easily accessible to developers that all of the accessibility problems will disappear overnight. But it is maybe the first hurdle that I think should be jumped over before we can start to make progress here.
Yeah, not true. And yeah, definitely it won't just overnight go away, because there's low hanging fruit that's still a problem on the web today. You know, alt.
Yeah.
Just decent use of the alt attribute, like that's still a problem, right? So and I mean, the other thing is, for me, like, and I think for a lot of people, including yourself, web performance is part of web accessibility, because for example, for me, like, we have this thing, a lot of places in the world has it, but we're experiencing it heavily in South Africa, is load shedding, which is this period of time where there's just no electricity. Now if you rely on mobile internet, the longer the power is off, the slower your connection gets, right? So you will find yourself, because the mobile towers, like, they have to conserve energy so they don't run out of battery power. So, and then some of them die. So now the distance between the one and the next tower is longer. So your connection slows down. Fun stuff like that. So you find yourself that at some point you're on like a slow 4G. And I can tell you that the web does not exist for people on slow 4G unless you have a lot of patience. But what's weird for me about the world web performance thing is there was a time where it felt like everyone was talking about web performance. It was like the thing that people talked about. And strangely enough, for the last 2 years or so, I've heard, like, even people like Tim Cadillac, you know, that's like one of the big voices there in that space. Even he's been quiet, or it's just that it's gone quiet. He talks about it a lot, but we don't hear about it as often anymore. And I wonder why that is, because I feel like with the adoption of all these frameworks, and like you said, with their heavy like payloads that just comes with it, their runtimes, we should be talking about web performance more, because, like, I can tell you, if you're trying to do a next site on a slow 4G, forget about it.
Yeah, I mean, Next has that sort of 200 kilobyte minimum JavaScript bundle size that they introduced, and yeah, that can be very hard on a website. I think there's probably a lot of things that are a lot of perspectives and different factors that have gone into maybe the the reduction of web performance evangelism, if you want to use that word. I think that Tim joining SpeedCurve recently is probably going to be a big change for how much he is publicly talking about web performance, and I would love to see him sort of ramp back up to that stuff. And yeah, I mean, I think that for me, the big web performance gathering right now is PerfNow in the Netherlands, and I really love that conference. And I think that, that has maybe picked back up this last year. I think that just the last couple of years have been hard on people. and I think just web performance generally is seeing the same sort of repercussions from the general tech landscape that everyone's seeing. I would love to see all of that stuff pick back up as quickly as folks can pick it back up. Just something happened a few years ago. I feel like that has maybe reverberated throughout the entire world from then till now. So yeah, I'm sure that web performance suffered those same repercussions.
Yeah, it's like your website's slow. Well, I'm dealing with a pandemic over here, so
yeah.
Hold my beer.
Yeah, and it's sort of wild to me to think about how the investment in online spaces sort of skyrocketed in like 2020, and people were just taking money left and right, and like all online spaces were, I don't know, all these companies that were sort of internet-focused and web-focused companies were skyrocketing to the moon for whatever reason. It's just much different now as we come down from that that rocket ship.
Some literally, you know, like Mr. Bezos, literally gotten.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, literally back from the rocket ship, whether we want him to or not.
So I think we're coming up on time, but there's just like two or three topics I'd love to touch on, and I'm going to try and mangle them together. So how do we support junior developers? Because I think they're going through a tough time with AI also now, and people see, doomsday sayers about you have no prospects in tech anymore. Copilot replaces all junior developers. Can open source, like I think it can, so I'd love to hear your thoughts, can open source and everything that happens around open source, can it play a role in creating opportunity and helping in creating a living roadmap, kind of like the HTML living standard, but an educational living roadmap that is curated by people to help these junior folks know, where do I start? How do I grow? And how do I get my first job? That's just a little less all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of talked even today a lot about on-ramps and how we make these on-ramps as beginner-friendly as possible and how we don't jump over points of complexity in the middle, or we don't gloss over things to make them seem easier than they are. For me, it really comes back to starting with fundamentals. And we talked about this resource where it just documents on-ramps of different types of tech. You start with this. This is level one, then level two. And I feel like a lot of maybe even just online courses probably already have this in place where they say this is the starter course for web components. Here's the intermediate course. And yeah, I mean, just I feel like just having links out to resources would be great. I think another thing that I've really sort of been obsessed with the last, I don't know, couple months is having a single resource that allows folks to search for community resources. I don't feel like that exists right now. I would love to see like a front of the front end web development search engine that is just community things that people have built and allows you to search for things in one place, just like almost a site index, like the old Yahoo like directory of all of these different individual resources that people have built. because I feel like as we move forward, search results from general purpose search engines are just going to get worse and worse. And you're kind of seeing that play out now. And social networks are becoming more and more fragmented as people sort of split out to where they feel most at home. And yeah, for me, that's not Twitter anymore. So like I'm big on Mastodon right now. So yeah, I see a lot of just communities getting fragmented in this way. And I think another part of that is just sort of the private nature of chat online now. Like a lot of communities have moved to private Discords and private Slacks, and you sort of think about how that can create hurdles for beginners. Because I feel like in some ways those chat networks are scarier than consuming resources just online without having, yeah, a bunch of people judging you instantly and in live feedback. But also just the access to information. I feel like learning information and resources shouldn't be hidden in private resources like chat like that. But I mean, Eleveny has a Discord, so I understand like the difference between, or there's value in having private spaces for people to talk about things in that way. And you can build a lot of community through that. So I don't know. I don't know what the best answer is, to be honest. I think that the only way we're going to get out of this is to build relationships with people. And I think that just having podcasts like this where we can come and talk about issues, I think is a big one. But I think the other one is just meeting people that you agree with, and meeting people that share similar interests to you online, I think is so important. So just from the beginning of my career, I knew I wanted to be a web developer. Even before web development was a career path. I knew that in my bones. Like I wanted to be a front-end web developer. And so I just like was so very, not necessarily aggressive, but very passionate about finding other people online that sort of identified in that way too. I didn't want to hang out with Java developers for whatever reason. Like I wanted to hang out with people that built websites and put things on the web and liked sharing what they knew. And yeah, the sharing aspect of the web was really the best part about it, because you can get instant feedback not just in your development cycle, when you can save something and see it reflected in the web browser instantly. Where you don't have that compile step of those heavier languages, server-side languages. But you also can get instant feedback from people reading your stuff and giving you feedback about what they thought about it and sharing what they know about it too. So I think that the only way that we're going to move forward here is just to, yeah, make more friends online and have better spaces for making friends online. And making those spaces accessible to as many people as we can, and making those spaces friendly to as many people as we can. I honestly don't think that, I know that I have like the static site generator and Eleveny has an Eleveny community, but I think that these spaces need to be, need to exist independent of these like tooling specific silos that exist. We need something bigger. And I think for a lot of folks, like when I think of resources like that, I think of like Smashing Magazine, I think of like CSS Tricks before it sold. And yeah, a lot of those spaces that exist as more general resources online where people can meet other people and connect with other people doing the same things that we want to do is the best way out of the mess that we're in right now.
Yeah, love that. What is some of the biggest, not necessarily the biggest thing, but if there is one, that's cool. But if not, what are some of the biggest things that you've learned by building Eleveny? And it doesn't even have to be a software coding thing.
I mean, a lot. I could probably talk about this question for a very long time. I think that one of the two biggest things that have challenged me personally is that you sort of learn a lot about yourself and building things like that, especially things that are, I don't want to say successful, but have a moderate amount of like public use. You start to really learn about what you're okay with and what you don't want to do. Like what, because people will ask you, please do this, please do this. There'll be an endless list of people asking you to do things and build things and support things. And it almost becomes a very uncomfortable exercise in saying no to a lot of people. And I think that just my personality specifically, I'm very much a people pleaser. Like I want to make everyone happy. And I think just personally, I've had to manage a lot of that line of when do I make someone else happy and when do I look out for myself and my own happiness? Because if I don't take care of my, it's kind of like the airplane thing where they say, put on your mask before helping someone else. Like, when do I take care of myself so that I have the energy to take care of that person in 6 months or whenever I have the energy to get back to what they said? And the answer at the end of that 6 months might be still no. I think it's been maybe the hardest thing that I've learned is just the getting better at saying no, saying no to people and delivering bad news to people. And I think that is just some real grown-up shit. It's a real grown-up lesson to learn.
Saying no is hard. Wow, I find it extremely hard.
It really
hard.
Is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, this was amazing. Thank you so much for sharing like more than an hour of your time, sharing everything.
Yeah, this was really fun.
It was great speaking with you. In closing up, where to from here? And how can people support you and your work?
Yeah, I mean, primarily I would just say if y'all want to keep in touch, go to my website, zachleat.com, zachleat.com. And alternatively, if you're interested in learning about 11D, you can go to 11ty.dev. We're doing a conference on May 9th. I don't know when this is going to be published, but May 9th is the conference. So it's a free conference. We have, I think, 850 people signed up right now. So it's going to be awesome.
Amazing. Thanks so much, Zach. Thanks for sharing your time. And thanks for all the cool things you build and share openly and freely with the world. I, for one, appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Mechanical Ink podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with your friends. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Have something to add? Continue the conversation on GitHub and join the community on Slack. Until the next one, keep all the things open.